drawing back into his single envelope. The effort it takes to extend any further is more than he can make alone. He hadn't thought he'd cry when she left, but he cried. Snot by the cubic yard, eyes like red carnations. Presently, every time his left foot hit the ground, walking, he'd get a jolt of pain through half his skull. Ah, this must be what they mean by the pain of separation. Pointsmen kept showing up with armloads of work. Roger found himself unable to forget Jessica and caring less about Slothrop. But one day Milton Gloaming popped in to deliver him from his unmoving. Gloaming was just back from a jaunt through the zone. He'd found himself on a task force with one Josef Schleim, a defector of secondary brilliance, who had once worked for the IG out of Dr. Reitinger's office, VOWI, the statistical department of NW7. There Schleim had been assigned to the American desk, gathering for the IG economic intelligence through subsidiaries and licensees like Chemnico, General Aniline and Film, Ansco, Winthrop. In 1936, he came to England to work for Imperial Chemicals, in a status that was never to be free from ambiguities. He'd heard of Slothrop, yes indeed, recalled him from the old days. When Lyle Bland went out on his last transmural journey, there'd been green reports flapping through the IG offices for weeks, geheime Kommandosache, rumors coupling and uncoupling like coal tar molecules under pressure, all to do with who was likely to take over the Slothrop surveillance now that Bland was gone. This was toward the beginning of the great struggle for the IG's intelligence machinery. The Economic Department of the Foreign Office and the Foreign Department of the Economic Office were both after it. So were the military, in particular the Wehrwirtschaftsstab, a section of the general staff that maintained OKW's liaison with industry. The IG's own liaison with OKW was handled by Vermittlungsstelle W, under Drs. Dieckmann and Gore. The picture was further confused by the usual duplicate Nazi Party offices, Abwehr organizations, set up throughout German industry after 1933. The Nazis' watchdog over the IG was called Abteilung A, and was set up in the same office building as, in fact it appeared perfectly congruent with, the IG's own army liaison group, Vermittlungsstelle W. But technology, alas, braid-crowned and gold-thighed maiden, always comes up for grabs like this. Most likely the bitching and bickering of army versus party was what finally drove Schleim over the hill, more than any moral feelings about Hitler. In any case, he remembers Slothrop surveillance being assigned to a newly created Sparta 4 under Vermittlungsstelle W. Sparta 1 was handling nitrogen and gasoline, 2 dyes, chemicals, Buna rubber, pharmaceuticals, 3 film and fibers. 4 handled Slothrop and nothing else except, Schleim had heard tell, one or two miscellaneous patents acquired through some dealings with IG Chemie in Switzerland. An analgesic whose name he couldn't recall, and a new plastic, some name like Mipolam, Polymex, or something. Sounds like that would have come under Sparta 2, was Gloaming's only comment at the time. A few directors were upset, Schleim agreed. Termeer was a Draufgänger. He and Horlein both, go-ahead fellows, they might have got it back. Did the party assign an Abwehrmann to this Sparta 4? They must have, but I don't know if he was SD or SS. There were so many of them around. I can remember some sort of rather thin chap with thick eyeglasses coming out of the office there once or twice, but he wore civilian clothes. Couldn't tell you his name. Well, now, what in the bloody hell? Surveillance? Roger is fidgeting heavily with his hair, his necktie, ears, nose, knuckles. I.G. Farben had Slothrop under surveillance before the war. What for, Gloaming? Odd, isn't it? Cheerio boying out the door without another word, leaving Roger alone with a most disagreeable light beginning to grow, the leading edge of a revelation, blinding, crescent at the periphery of his brain. I.G. Farben, huh? Mr. Pointsman has been chumming almost exclusively these days with upper echelon from ICI. ICI has cartel arrangements with Farben, the bastard. Why, he must have known about Slothrop all along. The Yampf business was only a front for... Well, say, what the hell is going on here? Halfway up to London, Pointsman has repossessed the Jaguar, so Roger's on a motorcycle from the Pisces pool, which consists now only of the cycle and one Morris with virtually no clutch. It occurs to him that Gloaming was sent around deliberately by Pointsman, as some obscure tactic in this Nayland Smith campaign he seems to be into. Pointsman owns a matched set of all the books in Saxe-Rohmer's great Manichaean saga, and is apt these days to pop in at any time, usually while Roger is sleeping or trying to take a quiet shit, and actually stand there in front of the toilet, reading aloud a pertinent text. Nothing is beyond Pointsman. He's worse than old Pudding was, no shame at all. He would use anyone, Gloaming, Katya, Borgesius, Pirate Prentice. No one is Jessica, exempt from his Jessica? Machiavellian Jessica. Oh, yes. Of course, Mexico, you fucking idiot. No wonder the 137th gave him the runaround. No wonder her orders came from too high. He had even Lamb frolicking about the spit, asked Pointsman to see what he could do. Fool, fool. He arrives at 12th House on Gallaho Mews in a homicidal state of mind. Bicycle thieves run down the back streets, old pros wheeling them three abreast at a good pace. Young men with natty mustaches preen in the windows. Children loot the dustbins. Courtyard corners are drifted with official papers, the shed skin of a beast at large. A tree has inexplicably withered in the street to a shingly black corpse. A fly lands belly up on the front fender of Roger's motorcycle, thrashes 10 seconds, folds its veined and sensitive wings, and dies. Quick as that. First one Roger has ever seen. P-47s fly over in squadron box formations, 4 check marks apiece, red, white, blue, yellow, on the unamended form of the whitish sky, squadron after squadron. It is either some military review or another war. A plasterer is busy around the corner, smoothing over a bomb-scarred wall, plaster heaped on his hawk luscious as cream cheese, using an unfamiliar trowel inherited from a dead friend. Still, these first days, digging holes like an apprentice, the shiny knife edge not yet broken to his hand, the curl of it a bit more than his own strength could have ever brought it to. Henry was a larger bloke. The fly, who was not dead, unfolds its wings and zooms off to fool somebody else. All right, Pointsman. Stomping into 12th House, rattling the corkboards down the 7 hallways and flights, receptionists making long arms for the telephone. Damn it, now where are you? Not in his office. But Geza Rozavolgi is, and tries to give Roger a hard time. You are making a spectacle of yourself, young man. Shut up, you Transylvanian twit, snarls Roger. I'm looking for the boss, see? One funny move out of you, and it's your last taste of O-negative, Jackson. Those fangs won't even be able to gum oatmeal when I'm through with you. Alarmed, Rozavolgi, retreating around the water cooler, tries to pick up a swivel chair to defend himself with. The seat falls off, and Rozavolgi is left with only the base, which happens, embarrassingly, to be shaped like a cross. Where is he? Mexican standoff. Roger, gritting his teeth. Do not succumb to hysteria. It is a counterproductive luxury you cannot, in your present great vulnerability, afford. Come on, you sod. Tell me, or you'll never see the inside of a coffin again. In runs a short but spunky secretary, bit of a chubette here, and commences belting Roger in the shins with the excess profits tax records from 1940 to 44 of an English steel firm, which happened to share a patent with Vereinigte Stahlwerke for an alloy used in the liquid oxygen couplings for the line running aft to the Escaret in A4 number 00000. But Roger's shins are not set up for this kind of information. The secretary's glasses fall off. Miss Müller Hochleben, reading her name tag, you look beastly without your glasses. Put them back on at once. This comic Nazi routine being inspired by her surname. I can't find them. German accent, all right. I don't see too well. Well, we'll see if we can't help you here. Ah, watch this, Miss Müller Hochleben.
Ja.
What do they look like, these eyeglasses?
They are right.
With clever little rhinestones all around the rims, Fräulein, eh?
Ja, ja, und mit...
And running down all the earpieces, too, eh? And feathers?
Ostrich feathers.
Male ostrich feathers dyed a stunning peacock blue sprouting off the edges.
That is my eyeglasses, ja,
says the groping secretary.
Where are they, please?
Right here, bringing his foot down, crunch, smashing them to bright arctic gatherings all over Pointsman's rug.
I say...
offers Rozavolgi from a far corner. The one corner of the room, by the way, which is not brightly lit. Yes, kind of an optic anomaly here. Just a straight, square room, no odd-shaped polyhedrons in 12th house. And still this strange, unaccountable prism of shadow in the corner. More than one visitor has popped in to find Mr. Pointsman not at his desk, where he ought to be, but standing in the shadow corner, most disturbingly facing into it. Rozhevolgi is not himself that fond of the corner. He's tried it a few times, but only came out shaking his head. "Mr. Pointsman, I don't like it in there at all. What possible kind of a thrill can anyone get from such an unwholesome experience, eh?" raising one crookedly wistful eyebrow. Pointsman had only looked apologetic, not for himself, but to something for Rozhevolgi, and said gently, "This is one spot in the room where I feel alive." Well, bet your ass one or two memos went up toward ministerial level over that one. If they reached the minister himself, it was probably as office entertainment. "Oh, yes, yes," shaking his wise old head of sheep's wool, high, almost Slavic cheekbones, crinkling his eyes up into an inattentive but polite laughter. "Yes, Pointsman's famous corner, yes, wouldn't be surprised if it was haunted, eh?" Reflex laughs from the underlings present, though only grim smiles from the overlings. "Get the S.P.R. in to have a look," giggles someone with a cigar. "The poor bloke will think he's back in the war again." "Hear, hear," and "That's a good one, all right," ring through the layering smoke. Practical jokes are all the rage among these particular underlings, a kind of class tradition. "You say what?" Roger has been screaming for a while.
"I say," says Rozhevolgi again.
"You say, I say, is that it? Then you should have said, I say, I say."
"I did."
"No, no, you said, I say, once, is what you..." "Aha, but I said it again, I said it twice." "But that was after I asked you the question. You can't tell me the two I says were both part of the same statement unless..." "That's asking me to be unreasonably..." "Unless it's really true, that credulous and around you, that's a form of..." "That we're the same person and that the whole exchange was one single thought." "Yah, and that means insanity, Rozhevolgi."
"My glasses,"
snivels Fräulein Müller-Hochleben, now crawling around the room, Mexico scattering the glass splinters with his shoe so that now and then the unfortunate girl will cut a hand or a knee, beginning to trail dark little feathers of blood for inches at a time, eventually, assuming she were to last long enough, dotting in Pointsman's rug like the train of a Beardsley gown. "You're doing fine, Miss Müller-Hochleben," cries Roger encouragingly, "and as for you, you..." But is stopped on noticing how Rozhevolgi now is nearly invisible in the shadow and how the whites of his eyes are actually glowing white, jittering around in the air, winking out, coming back. It is costing Rozhevolgi an effort to stay in this shadow corner. It is not at all his sort of place. For one thing, the rest of the room seems to be at more of a distance, as through the viewfinder on a camera. And the walls, they don't appear to be, well, solid, actually. They flow. A coarse, a viscous passage, rippling like a standing piece of silk or nylon, the color watery gray, but now and then with a surprise island in the flow, some color absolutely foreign to this room, saffron spindles, palm green ovals, magenta firths running comb-like into jagged comic book orange chunks of island as the wounded fighter plane circles, jettisons the tanks, then the silver canopy, sets the flaps to just above a stall, wheels up as the blue, suddenly such a violent blue, rushes in just before impact throttle closed. Oh, shit, the reef. We're going to smash up on the... Oh, there's no reef? We're safe? We are. Mangoes. I see mangoes on that tree over there. Hey, and there's a girl. There's a lot of girls. Look it. They're all gorgeous. Their tits point straight out. And they're all swinging those grass skirts, playing ukuleles and singing. Though, why are the voices so hard and tough, so nasally like the voices of an American chorus line?
"White man, welcome to Pukahukaluki Island. One taste of my papaya, and you'll never wanna go away. Moon like a yellow banana, hanging over my cabana, and lots of hula hula games to play. Oh, the stars are falling over Pukahukaluki Island, and the lava down the mountain's running scrumptious as a cherry pie. Even sweet Leilani in the little grass shack loves a coconut monkey and a missionary snack. Looky, looky, sugar cookie, you're on Pukahukaluki Island."
Oh boy, oh boy, going to nail me. One of those little island lovelies spend the rest of my life,
eating papayas fragrant as the cunt of young paradise.
When paradise was young. The pilot is turning to Rojavolgi, who is still strapped in safety harness behind him. The face is covered with helmet, goggles that reflect too much light, oxygen mask, a face of metal, leather, isinglass. But now the pilot is raising the goggles slowly, and whose eyes are these, so familiar, smiling, "Hello, I know you, don't you know me, don't you really know me?" Rojavolgi screams and backs out of the corner, shivering, blinded now in the overhead lights. Fräulein Müller-Hochleben is crawling around and around in the same circle, faster and faster, nearly a blur, croaking hysterically. Both have reached the exact level Roger's subtle psychological campaign here was intended to work them up to. Quietly but firmly, "Right, now, for the last time, where is Mr. Pointsman?"
"Moss Moon's office," they reply in unison.
Moss Moon's office is a roller skate ride away from Whitehall and guarded by room after room of sentinel girls, each of them wearing a frock of a radically different color from the others. And this goes on for a while, so you can imagine what three sigma colors these are to begin with, if that many can be so radically different, you know, like that, oh, colors such as lizard, evening star, pale Atlantis, to name a few. And whom Roger romances, bribes, threatens, double-talks, and, sigh, yes, punches his way through, till finally Moss Moon, pounding on this gigantic oak door, carved like the stone doorways of certain temples, "Pointsman, the jig's up, in the name of whatever marginal decency enables you to get through the day without being shot dead by the odd armed stranger, open this door." This is quite a long speech, and the door actually opens halfway through, but Roger finishes it up anyhow. He's looking into a room of incandescent lemon-lime, subdued drastically, almost to the milky point of absinthe and water, a room warmer than this table full of faces really deserves, but perhaps it's Roger's entrance that deepens the color a bit now as he runs and jumps on the polished table over the polished head of a director of a steel company, skidding 20 feet down the waxed surface to confront the man at the end, who sits with a debonair, well, snotty, smile on his face. "Moss Moon, I'm on to you." Has he actually come inside, in among the hoods, eye slits, gold paraphernalia, the incense and the thigh-bone scepter? "That's not Moss Moon," Mr. Pointsman, clearing his throat as he speaks. "Mexico, do come down off the table, won't you? Gentlemen, one of my old Pisces colleagues, brilliant but rather unstable, as you may have noted. Oh, Mexico, really." Roger has unbuttoned his fly, taken his cock out, and is now busy pissing on the shiny table, the papers, in the ashtrays, and pretty soon on these poker-faced men themselves, who, although executive material all right, men of hair-trigger minds, are still not quite willing to admit that this is happening, you know, in any world that really touches, at too many points, the one they're accustomed to. And actually the fall of warm piss is quite pleasant as it sweeps by, across 10 guinea cravats, creative-looking little beards, up into a liver-spotted nostril, across a pair of army-issue steel-rim eyeglasses, slashing up and down starched fronts, Phi Beta Kappa keys, Legions of Honor, Orders of Lenin, Iron Crosses, VCs, retirement watch chains, Dewey for President lapel pins, half-exposed service revolvers, and even a sawed-off shotgun under the shoulder there. "Pointsman!" The cock, stubborn, annoyed, bucks like an airship among purple clouds, very dense purple as pile velvet, that color. At nightfall, when the sea breeze promises a difficult landing, "I've saved you for last, but, goodness, I don't seem to have any urine left here. Not even a drop. I'm so sorry, nothing left for you at all. Do you understand? If it means giving my life..." The words have just come out, and maybe Roger's exaggerating, but maybe not. "There will be nothing anywhere for you. What you get, I'll take. If you go higher in this, I'll come and get you and take you back down, wherever you go. Even should you find a spare moment of rest with an understanding woman in a quiet room, I'll be at the window. I'll always be just outside. You will never cancel me. If you come out, I'll go in, and the room will be defiled for you, haunted, and you'll have to find another. If you stay inside, I'll come in anyway. I'll stalk you room to room till I corner you in the last. You'll have the last room, Pointsman, and you'll have to live in it the rest of your scum-prostituted life." Pointsman won't look at him, won't meet his eyes. That's what Roger wanted. The security police show up as an anticlimax, although aficionados of the chase scene, those who cannot look at the Taj Mahal, the Uffizi, the Statue of Liberty without thinking chase scene, wow, yeah, Douglas Fairbanks scampering across that moon minaret there, these enthusiasts may find interest in the following. Roger dives under the table to unbutton his fly, and the zealous flatties leap at each other over the top of the table, colliding and cursing. But Roger has gone scuttling down the horsehide, hobnailed, pinstriped, mom's argyle-socked sub-level of these conspirators above, a precarious passage any 1 foot could kick untelegraphed and wipe him out, till he arrives back at the bald steel magnate, reaches up, grabs him by the necktie or the cock, whichever it's easiest to get a hold on, and drags the man down under the table. "Right, now we're going to get out of here, and you're my hostage. Get it?" He emerges, dragging the livid executive by his necktie or cock, pulling him like a child's sleigh, strangling and apoplectic out the door, past the modally unusual rainbow of sentinel ladies, now intimidated looking, at least, sirens already wailing in the street, "Maniac assaults oil parley, ousted after blanking on contraries," and he's out of the elevator by now, running down a back corridor to a central heating complex, zoom, over the heads of a couple of black custodians who are passing back and forth a cigarette roll from some West African narcotic herb, stuffs his hostage into a gigantic furnace, which is banked for the spring, too bad, and flees up the back way down an aisle of plane trees into a small park, over a fence, zippity-zop, fast-foot Roger and the London cops. There's nothing back at the White Visitation he really needs, nothing he can't let go. Clothes on his back, and the pool motorcycle, a pocketful of spare change, and anger unlimited, what more does a 30-year-old innocent need to make his way in the city? "I'm fucking Dick Whittington," it occurs to him, zooming down King's Road. "I've come to London. I'm your Lord Mayor." Pirate is home, and apparently expecting Roger. Pieces of his faithful Mendoza lie about the refectory table, shining with oil or bluing, wads, patches. Rods, bottles occupy his hands, but his eager eyes are on Roger. "No," cutting into a denunciation of Pointsman when Milton Gloaming's name comes up. "It's a minor item, but stop right there. Pointsman didn't send him. We sent him." "We? You're a novice paranoid, Roger." First time Prentice has ever used his Christian name, and it touches Roger enough to check his tirade. "Of course, a well-developed they system is necessary, but it's only half the story. For every they, there ought to be a we. In our case, there is. Creative paranoia means developing at least as thorough a we system as a they system." "Wait, wait. First, where's the Hague and Hague? Be a gracious host. Second, what is a they system? I don't pull Chebyshev's theorem on you, do I?" "I mean what they and their hired psychiatrists call delusional systems. Needless to say, delusions are always officially defined. We don't have to worry about questions of real or unreal. They only talk out of expediency. It's the system that matters. How the data arrange themselves inside it. Some are consistent, others fall apart. Your idea that Pointsman sent Gloaming takes a wrong fork. Without any contrary set of delusions, delusions about ourselves, which I'm calling a we system, the Gloaming idea might have been all right. Delusions about ourselves, not real ones. But officially defined... out of expediency, yes." "Well, you're playing their game, then." "Don't let it bother you. You'll find you can operate quite well, seeing as we haven't won yet. It isn't really much of a problem." Roger is totally confused. At this point, in wanders who but Milton Gloaming, with a black man Roger recognizes now as one of the two herb smokers in the furnace room under Clive Mossmoon's office. His name is Jan Otyeyeyumbu, and he's a Schwartz Commando liaison man. One of blotted Waxwing's Apache lieutenants shows up with his girl, who's not walking so much as dancing, very fluid and slow, a dance in which Osby Feel, popping out of the kitchen now with his shirt off and a Porky Pig tattoo on his stomach, how long has Feel had that, correctly identifies the influence of heroin. It's a little bewildering. If this is a we system, why isn't it at least thoughtful enough to interlock in a reasonable way like they systems do? "That's exactly it," Osby screams, belly dancing Porky into a wide alarming grin. "They're the rational ones. We piss on their rational arrangements, don't we, Mexico?" "Hurrah," cry the others. "Well taken, Osby." Sir Stephen Dotson Truck sits by the window, cleaning a stem. Outside, blowing over its dorsal and summer stillness, London today can feel advanced chills of austerity. There isn't a word in Sir Stephen's head right now. He is completely involved with the weapon. He no longer thinks about his wife, Nora, although she's out there in some room, still surrounded by her planetary psychics, and aimed herself now toward a peculiar fate. In recent weeks, in true messianic style, it has come clear to her that her real identity is, literally, the force of gravity. I am gravity. I am that against which the rocket must struggle, to which the prehistoric wastes submit and muted to the very substance of history. Her wheeling freaks, her seers, teleporters, astral travelers, and tragic human interfaces all know of her visitation, but none see any way for her to turn. She must prove herself now, find deeper forms of renunciation, deeper than Shabtai Tzvi's apostasy before the sublime port. It is a situation not without its chances for a good, practical joke now and then. Poor Nora will be suckered into seances that wouldn't fool your great aunt. Visits from the likes of Ronald Cherrycoke in a Jesus Christ get-up, whistling down the wires into a hidden ultraviolet baby spot, where he will start fluorescing in most questionable taste, blithering odd bits of gospel together, reaching down from his crucified altitudes to actually cop feels of Nora's girdled behind. Highly offended, she will flee into hallways full of clammy invisible hands. Poltergeists will back toilets up on her. Ladylike turds will bob at her virgin vertex, and screaming, ugh, ass dripping, girdle around her knees, she will go staggering into her own drawing room to find no refuge even there. No, someone will have caused to materialize for her a lesbian elephant soisant nerf, slimy trunks pistoning symmetrically in and out of juicy elephant vulvas. And when she turns to escape this horrible exhibition, she'll find some playful ghost has latched the door behind her, and another's just about to suck her in the face with a cold Yorkshire pudding. In Pirate's Maisonette, everyone is singing now a counterforce traveling song, with Thomas Gwenhydwy, who has not fallen to the dialectic curse of Pointsman's book after all, accompanying on what seems to be a rosewood cruth. They've been sleeping on your shoulder, they've been crying in your beer, and they've sung you all their sad lullabies, and you thought they wanted sympathy and didn't care for souls, and they never were about to put you wise. But I'm telling you today that it ain't the only way, and there's shit you won't be eating any more. They've been paying you to love it, but the time has come to shove it, and it isn't a resistance, it's a war. It's a war, Roger sings, driving into Cuxhaven, wondering offhand how Jessica has cut her hair for Jeremy, and how that insufferable prig would look with a thrust chamber wrapped around his head. It's a war. Light one up before you mosey out that door, once you cuddled them and kissed them, but we're bringing down their system, and it isn't a resistance, it's a war. These pine limbs, crackling so blue and watery, don't seem to put out any heat at all. Confiscated weapons and ammo lie around half-crated or piled loose inside the Sea Company perimeter. For days, the U.S. Army has been out sweeping Thuringia, busting into houses in the middle of the night. A certain lycanthropophobia fear of werewolves occupies minds at higher levels. Winter is coming. Soon there won't be enough food or coal in Germany. Potato crops toward the end of the war, for example, all went to make alcohol for the rockets. But there are still small arms aplenty, and ammunition to fit them. Where you cannot feed, you take away weapons. Weapons and food have been firmly linked in the governmental mind for as long as either has been around. On the mountainsides, patches will flash up now and then, bright as Dittany in July at the Zippo's ceremonial touch. PFC Eddie Pensiero, a replacement here in the 89th Division, also an amphetamine enthusiast, sits huddling nearly on top of the fire, shivering and watching the divisional patch on his arm, which ordinarily resembles a cluster of rocket noses seen out of a dilating asshole, all in black and olive drab, but which now looks like something even stranger than that, which Eddie will think of in a minute. Shivering is one of Eddie Pensiero's favorite pastimes. Not the kind of shiver normal people get, the goose on the grave pass over and gone, but shivering that doesn't stop. Very hard to get used to at first. Eddie is a connoisseur of shivers. He is even able in some strange way to read them, like Zoira Buma reads reefers, like Miklos Tanats reads whip scars. But the gift isn't limited just to Eddie's own shivers, oh no, they're other people's shivers too. Yeah, they come in one by one. They come in all together in groups. Lately he's been growing in his brain a kind of discriminator circuit, learning how to separate them out. Least interesting of these shivers are the ones with a perfectly steady frequency, no variation to them at all. The next to least interesting are the frequency-modulated kind, now faster, now slower, depending on information put in at the other end, wherever that might be. Then you have the irregular waveforms that change both in frequency and in amplitude.
They have to be Fourier analyzed into their harmonics, which is a little tougher. There is often coding involved, certain sub-frequencies, certain power levels. You have to be pretty good to get the hang of these. Hey, Pensiero. It is Eddie's sergeant, Howard Slow Lerner. Get your ass off of that fire. Aw, Sarge, chatters Eddie. Come on, I was just trying to get warm. No excuses, Pensiero. One of the colonels wants his hair cut right now, and you're it. Ah, use guys, mutters Pensiero, crawling over to his sleeping bag and looking through his pack for comb and scissors. He is the company barber. His haircuts, which take hours and often days, are immediately recognizable throughout the zone, revealing as they do the hair-by-hair single-mindedness of the Benny habitué. The colonel is sitting, waiting, under an electric bulb. The bulb is receiving its power from another enlisted man who sits back in the shadows, hand-pedaling the twin generator cranks. It is Eddie's friend, Private Paddy Electro McGonagall, an Irish lad from New Jersey, one of those million virtuous and adjusted city poor you know from the movies. You've seen them dancing, singing, hanging out the washing on the lines, getting drunk at wakes, worrying about their children going bad. I just don't know any more, Father. He's a good boy, but he's running with a cool crowd. On through every wretched Hollywood lie down to and including this year's big hit, A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. With his crank here, young Paddy is practicing another form of Eddie's gift, though he's transmitting, not receiving. The bulb appears to burn steadily, but this is really a succession of electric peaks and valleys, passing by at a speed that depends on how fast Paddy is cranking. It's only that the wire inside the bulb unbrightens slow enough before the next peak shows up that fools us into seeing a steady light. It's really a train of imperceptible light and dark, usually imperceptible. The message is never conscious on Paddy's part. It is sent by muscles and skeleton, by that circuit of his body which has learned to work as a source of electrical power. Right now, Eddie Pensiero is shivering and not paying much attention to that light bulb. His own message is interesting enough. Somebody close by, out in the night, is playing a blues on a mouth harp. What's that? Eddie wants to know, standing under the white light behind the silent colonel in his dress uniform. Hey, McGonagall, you hear something? Yeah, jeers Paddy from behind the generator. I hear your discharge flying away with big wings coming out of the ass end. That's what I hear, yuck, yuck. End of side 20. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette. Side 21. Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Pynchon. Continuing on page 748.
Ah, it's the bunk, replies Eddie Pensiero. You don't hear no discharge, you big dumb-headed mick. Hey, Pensiero, you know what an Italian submarine sounds like on that new sonar, huh?
What?
Ping, guinea, 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 whap, whap, whap. That's what. Yuck, yuck, yuck.
Fuck yous, says Eddie, and commences combing the colonel's silver-black hair. The moment the comb contacts his head, the colonel begins to speak. Ordinarily, we'd spend no more than 24 hours on a house-to-house sweep, sundown to sundown, house-to-house. There's a quality of black and gold to either end of it, that way, silhouettes, shaken skies, pure as a cyclorama. But these sunsets out here, I don't know. Do you suppose something has exploded somewhere? Really, somewhere in the east? Another Krakatoa? Another name, at least that exotic. The colors are so different now. Volcanic ash, or any finely divided substance suspended in the atmosphere, can diffract the colors strangely. Did you know that, son? Hard to believe, isn't it? Rather a long taper, if you don't mind, and just short of combable on top. Yes, Private, the colors change, and how? The question is, are they changing according to something? Is the sun's everyday spectrum being modulated? Not at random, but systematically by this unknown debris in the prevailing winds, is there information for us. Deep questions and disturbing ones.
Where you from, son? I'm from Kenosha, Wisconsin. My folks have a little farm back there, snow fields and fence posts all the way to Chicago. The snow covers the old cars up on blocks in the yards, big white bundles. It looks like Graves registration back there in Wisconsin.
Hey, Pensiero, calls Paddy McGonagall. You still hearing that sound?
Yeah, I think it's a mouth organ.
Pensiero busily combing up single hairs, cutting each one a slightly different length, going back again and again to touch up here and there. God is who knows their number.
Atropos is who severs them to different lengths. So, God under the aspect of Atropos, she who cannot be turned, is in possession of Eddie Pensiero tonight.
I got your mouth organ,
jeers Paddy.
Right here, look, a wop clarinet.
Each long haircut is a passage. Hair is yet another kind of modulated frequency. Assume a state of grace in which all hairs were once distributed perfectly even, a time of innocence when they fell perfectly straight all over the colonel's head. Winds of the day, gestures of distraction, sweat, itchings, sudden surprises, 3-foot falls to the edge of sleep, watched skies, remembered shames, all have since written on that perfect grating. Passing through it tonight, restructuring it, Eddie Pensiero is an agent of history. Along with the reworking of the colonel's head runs the shiver-born blues. Long runs in number 2 and 3 hole correspond, tonight anyway, to passages in the deep reaches of hair, birch trunks in a very humid state, approaches to a stone-wooded park, stags beside the high flags. It's a matter of lower sideband. You suck a clear note on pitch and then bend it lower with the muscles of your face. Muscles of your face have been laughing, tight with pain, often not to betray any emotion. Where you send the pure note is partly a function of that. There's that secular basis for blues, if the spiritual angle bothers you.
Oh, where I was, relates the colonel, I kept climbing down these big sheared chunks of concrete, black reinforcing rod poking out, black rust. There were touches of royal purple in the air, not to blur out over their edges or change the substance of the night. They dribbled down, lengthening out, one by one. Ever seen a chicken fetus, just beginning? Oh, of course not. You're a city boy. There's a lot to learn out of the farm. Teaches you what a chicken fetus is, so that if you happen to be climbing down a concrete mountain in the dark and see one or several up in the sky reproduced in purple, you'll know what they look like. That's a heap better than the city, son. There you just move from crisis to crisis. Each one brand new. Nothing to couple it back onto.
Well, there he is, cautiously edging along the enormous ruin, his hair at the moment looking very odd. Forward and up in great long points, forming a black sunflower or sunbonnet around his face, in which the prominent feature is the colonel's long, crawling, magenta lips. Things grab up for him out of crevices among the debris. Sort of fast, happy lunge out and back in. Thin pincer arms, nothing personal. Just thought I'd grab a little night air, ha ha. When they miss the colonel, as they always seem to do, why, they just zip back in with a gambler's ho-hum. Well, maybe next time. Damn it. Cut off from my regiment here, going to be captured and cremated by dacoits. Jesus, there they are now, unthinkable animals running low in the light from the G5 version of the city. Red and yellow turbans, scarred, dope-fiend faces, fared as the front end of a 37 Ford. Same undirected eyes, same exemption from the karmic hammer. The 37 Ford exempt from the KH? Come on, quit fooling. They'll all end up in junkyards, same as the rest. Oh, will they, Skippy? Why are there so many on the roads, then? Mr. Information, the war, I mean, there's no new cars being built right now, so we all have to keep our old reliable in tip-top shape, because there's not too many mechanics left here on the home front, eh? And we shouldn't hoard gas, and we should keep that A sticker prominently displayed in the lower right. Skippy, you little fool, you are off on another of your senseless and retrograde journeys. Come back here to the points. Here's where the paths divided. See the man back there? He is wearing a white hood. His shoes are brown. He has a nice smile, but nobody sees it. Nobody sees it because his face is always in the dark. But he is a nice man. He is the pointsman. He is called that because he throws the lever that changes the points. And we go to Happyville instead of to Payne City or Der Leidstadt. That's what the Germans call it. There is a mean poem about the Leidsch German man named Mr. Rilke. But we will not read it because we are going to Happyville. The pointsman has made sure we'll go there. He hardly has to work at all. The lever is very smooth and easy to push. Even you could push it, Skippy, if you knew where it was. But look what a lot of work he has done with just one little push. He has sent us all the way to Happyville instead of to Payne City. That is because he knows just where the points and the lever are. He is the only kind of man who puts in very little work and makes big things happen all over the world. He could have sent you on the right trip back there, Skippy. You can have your fantasy if you want. You probably don't deserve anything better, but Mr. Information tonight is in a kind mood. He will show you Happyville.
He will begin by reminding you of the 1937 Ford. Why is that dacoit-faced auto still on the roads? The war, just as you rattled over the points onto the wrong track. The war was the set of points, eh? Yes, yes, Skippy. The truth is that the war is keeping things alive. Things. The Ford is only one of them. The Germans and Japs story was only one, rather surrealistic version of the real war. The real war is always there. The dying tapers off now and then, but the war is still killing lots and lots of people, only right now it is killing them in more subtle ways. Often in ways that are too complicated, even for us at this level, to trace. But the right people are dying, just as they do when armies fight. The ones who stand up, in basic, in the middle of the machine gun pattern. The ones who do not have faith in their sergeants. The ones who slip and show a moment's weakness to the enemy. These are the ones the war cannot use, and so they die. The right ones survive. The others, it's said, even know they have a short life expectancy, but they persist in acting the way they do. Nobody knows why. Wouldn't it be nice if we could eliminate them completely? Then no one would have to be killed in the war. That would be fun, wouldn't it, Skippy? Jeepers, it sure would, Mr. Information. Wow, I can't wait to see Happyville. Happily, he doesn't have to wait at all. Dacoits comes leaping, whistling sound, ecru silk cord strung buzzing tight between his fists, eager let's-get-to-it grin, and just at the same moment a pair of arms comes up out of a fissure in the ruins and gathers the colonel down to safety just in time. The dacoit falls on his ass and sits there trying to pull the cord apart, muttering, oh shit, which even dacoits do, too. You are under the mountain, a voice announces. Stony cave acoustics in here. Please remember from this point on to obey all pertinent regulations. His guide is a kind of squat robot, dark gray plastic with rolling headlamp eyes, shaped something like a crab. That's cancer in Latin, says the robot, and in Kenosha too. It will prove to be addicted to one-liners that never quite come off for anyone but it. Here is Muffin Tin Road, announces the robot. Note the smiling faces on all the houses here. Upstairs windows are eyes, picket fences teeth, nose is the front door. Say, asks the colonel, taken by a sudden thought, does it ever snow, Happyville? Does what ever snow? You're evading. I'm evading room Vino from Wisconsin, sings this boorish machine. And you ought to see the nurses run. So what else is new, Jackson? The squat creature is actually chewing gum, a Laszlo Jampf variation on polyvinyl chloride, very malleable, even sending out detachable molecules which, through an ingenious osmoelektrische Schalterwerke developed by Siemens, is transmitting in code a damn fair approximation of Beeman's licorice flavor to the robot crab's brain. Mr. Information always answers questions. For what he's making, I'd even question answers. Does it ever snow? Of course it snows in Happyville. A lot of snowmen would sure be sore if it didn't. I recall back in Wisconsin, the wind used to blow right up the walk, like a visitor who expects to be let in. Sweeps the snow up against the front door, leaves it drifted there. Ever get that in Happyville? Old stuff, says the robot. Anybody ever open his front door while the wind was doing that, eh? Thousands of times. Then, pounces the colonel, if the door is the house's nose and the door is open, eh, and all of those snowy white crystals are blowing up from Muffin Tin Road in a big cloud right into the... Ah! Screams the plastic robot and scuttles away into a narrow alley. The colonel finds himself alone in a brown and wine-aged district of the city. Sandstone and adobe colors sweep away in a progress of walls, rooftops, streets. Not a tree in sight. And who's this comes strolling down the Schokoladestrasse? Why, it's Laszlo Jampf himself, grown to a prolonged old age, preserved like a 37 Ford against the world's ups and downs, which are never more than damped out changes in smile, wide pearly to wistfully gauze inside Happyville here. Dr. Jampf is wearing a bow tie of a certain limp grayish lavender, a color for long dying afternoons through conservatory windows, minor keyed leader about days gone by, plaintive pianos, pipe smoke in a stuffy parlor, overcast Sunday walks by canals. Here the two men are dry-scratched precisely, attentively on this afternoon, and the bells across the canal are tolling the hour. The men have come from very far away, after a journey neither quite remembers, on a mission of some kind, but each has been kept ignorant of the other's role.
Now, it turns out that this light bulb over the current here is the same identical Osram light bulb that Franz Perkler used to keep next to in his bunk at the underground rocket works at Nordhausen. Statistically, so their story goes, every N-thousandth light bulb is going to be perfect. All the delta Qs piling up just right, so we shouldn't be surprised that this one's still around, burning brightly. But the truth is even more stupendous. This bulb is immortal. It's been around, in fact, since the 20s, has that old-timery point at the tip and is less pear-shaped than more contemporary bulbs. What a history, this bulb, if only it could speak. Well, as a matter of fact, it can speak. It is dictating the muscular modulations of Paddy McGonagall's cranking tonight. This is a loop here with feedback through Paddy to the generator again. Here it is, the story of Byron the Bulb. Byron was to have been manufactured by Tungsram in Budapest. He would probably have been grabbed up by the ace salesman, Géza Rozsavolgyi's father, Sándor, who covered all the Transylvanian territory and had begun to go native enough to where the Home Office felt vaguely paranoid about him throwing some horrible spell on the whole operation if they didn't give him what he wanted. Actually, he was a salesman who wanted his son to be a doctor, and that came true. But it may have been the bad witch-leery auras around Budapest that got the birth of Byron reassigned at the last minute to Osram in Berlin. Reassigned, yes. There is a bulb baby heaven. Amiably satirized as if it was the movies or something. Well, big business, ha-ha. But don't let them fool you. This is a bureaucracy first, and a bulb baby heaven only as a sort of sideline. All overhead, yes, out of its own pocket, the company is springing for square leagues of organdy, hogsheads of IG Farben pink and blue baby dye, hundredweights of clever Siemens electric baby bulb pacifiers, giving the suckling bulb the shape of a 110-volt current without the least trickle of power. One way or another, these bulb folks are in the business of providing the appearance of power, power against the night, without the reality. Actually, BBH is rather shabby. The brown rafters drip cobwebs. Now and then a roach shows up on the floor, and all the babies try to roll over to look. Being bulbs, they seem perfectly symmetrical, Skippy, but don't forget the contact at the top of the thread, going, ugh, ugh, glowing feebly at the bewildered roach sitting paralyzed and squashable out on the bare boards, rushing, reliving the terror of some sudden blast of current out of nowhere and high overhead the lambent, all-seeing bulb. In their innocence, the baby bulbs don't know what to make of this roach's abreaction. They feel his fright, but don't know what it is. They just want to be his friend. He's interesting and has good moves. Everybody's excited except for Byron, who considers the other bulb babies a bunch of saps. It is a constant struggle to turn their thoughts on anything meaningful. Hi there, babies. I'm Byron the Bulb, here to sing a little song to you that goes, light up and shine, you incandescent bulb babies. Looks like you got rabies. Just lay there foaming and a-screaming like a bunch of little demons. I'm delivering unto you a kingdom of roaches, and nothing approaches that joyful feeling when you're up on the ceiling looking down night and day on the kingdom you survey. They'll come out and love you till the break of dawn, but they run like hell when that light comes on. So shine on, baby bulbs, you're the wave of the future, and I'm here to recruit you in my great crusade. Just sing along, babies, come on and join the big parade. Trouble with Byron's, he's an old, old soul trapped inside the glass prison of a baby bulb. He hates this place. Lying on his back, waiting to get manufactured. Nothing to listen to on the speakers but Charleston music. Now and then an address to the nation. What kind of a setup's that? Byron wants to get out of here and into it. Needless to say, he's been developing all kinds of nervous ailments. Baby bulb diaper rash, which is a sort of corrosion on his screw threads. Bulb baby colic, a tight spasm of high resistance someplace among the deep loops of tungsten wire. Bulb baby hyperventilation, where it actually feels like his vacuum's been broken, though there is no organic basis. When M-Day finally does roll around, you can bet Byron's elated. He has passed the time hatching some really insane, grandiose plans. He's going to organize all the bulbs, see? Get him a power base in Berlin. He's already hep to the strobing tactic. All you do is develop the knack, yogic almost, of shutting off and on at a rate close to the human brain's alpha rhythm. And you can actually trigger an epileptic fit. True. Byron has had a vision against the rafters of his ward of 20 million bulbs all over Europe at a given synchronizing pulse arranged by one of his many agents in the grid, all these bulbs beginning to strobe together. Humans thrashing around the 20 million rooms like fish on the beaches of perfect energy. Attention, humans! This has been a warning to you. Next time a few of us will explode. Ha ha! Yes, we'll unleash our kamikaze squad of the Kyrgyz light. Well, that's the ass end of a firefly compared to what we're gonna... Oh, you haven't heard of the... Oh, well, too bad. Because a few bulbs, say a million, a mere 5% of our number, are more than willing to flame out in one grand burst instead of patiently waiting out their design hours. So Byron dreams of his guerrilla strike force. Gonna get Herbert Hoover, Stanley Baldwin, all of them, right in the face with one coordinated blast. Is Byron in for a rude awakening? There is already an organization, a human one, known as Phoebus, the International Light Bulb Cartel, headquartered in Switzerland. Run pretty much by International GE, Osram, and Associated Electrical Industries of Britain, which are in turn owned 100%, 29%, and 46% respectively by the General Electric Company in America. Phoebus fixes the prices and determines the operational lives of all the bulbs in the world, from Brazil to Japan to Holland, although Philips in Holland is the mad dog of the cartel, apt at any time to cut loose and sow disaster throughout the great combination. Given this state of general repression, there seems no place for a newborn baby bulb to start but at the bottom. But Phoebus doesn't know yet that Byron is immortal. He starts out his career at an all-girl opium den in Charlottenburg, almost within sight of the statue of Werner Siemens, burning up in a sconce, one among many bulbs witnessing the more languorous forms of Republican decadence. He gets to know all the bulbs in the place. Benito the bulb over in the next sconce, who's always planning an escape. Bernie down the hall in the toilet, who has all kinds of Eurolagnia jokes to tell. His mother Brenda in the kitchen, who talks of hashish hush puppies. Dildos rigged to pump floods of paregoric orgasm to the capillaries of the womb. Prayers to Astarte and Lilith, queen of the night, reaches into the true night of the other, cold and naked on linoleum floors after days without sleep. The dreams and tears become a natural state. One by one, over the months, the other bulbs burn out and are gone. The first few of these hit Byron hard. He's still a new arrival, still hasn't accepted his immortality, but on through the burning hours he starts to learn about the transience of others. Learns that loving them while they're here becomes easier and also more intense. To love as if each design hour will be the last. Byron soon enough becomes a permanent old-timer. Others can recognize his hate, but it's never discussed, except in a general way when folklore comes flickering in from other parts of the grid. Tales of the immacabalists' study in Lyon, who's supposed to know magic, another in Norway, outside a warehouse facing arctic whiteness with a stoicism more subtly bulbs begin strobing faintly just at the thought of. If other immortals are out there, they remain silent. But it is a silence with much, perhaps everything, in it. After love, then, Byron's next lesson is silence. As his burning lengthens towards 600 hours, the monitors in Switzerland begin to keep more of an eye on Byron. The Phoebus surveillance room is located under a little-known alp, a chilly room crammed full of German electro-hardware, glass, brass, ebonite, and silver, massive terminal blocks shaggy with copper clips and screws, and a cadre of super-clean, white-robed watchers who wander meter to meter, light as snow devils, making sure that nothing's going wrong, that through no bulb shall the mean operating life be extended. You can imagine what it would do to the market if that started happening. Byron passes surveillance's red line at 600 hours, and immediately, As a matter of routine, he is checked out for filament resistance, burning temperature, vacuum, power consumption. Everything's normal. Now Byron is to be checked out every 50 hours hereafter. A soft chime will go off in the monitoring station whenever it's time. At 800 hours, another routine precaution, a Berlin agent is sent out to the opium den to bring asbestos-lined kid gloves and 7-inch spike heels. No, not so she can fit in with the crowd, but so that she can reach that sconce to unscrew Byron. The other bulbs watch in barely subdued terror. The word goes out along the grid. At something close to the speed of light, every bulb, azos looking down the empty black Bakelite streets, Nitralampen and Wotangis at night soccer matches, used Wolframs, Monowatts, and Siriuses, every bulb in Europe knows what's happened. They are silent with impotence, with surrender in the face of struggles they thought were all myth. We can't help, this common thought humming through pastures of sleeping sheep, down autobahns and to the bitter ends of coaling piers in the north. There's never been anything we could do. Anyone shows us the meanest hope of transcending, and the Committee on Incandescent Anomalies comes in and takes him away. Some do protest, maybe, here and there, but it's only information. Glow-modulated, harmless, nothing close to the explosions in the faces of the powerful that Byron once envisioned, back there in his baby ward, in his innocence. He is taken to Neukölln, to a basement room, the home of a glassblower who is afraid of the night and who will keep Byron glowing and on watch over all the flint bowls, the griffins and flower ships, ibixes in mid-leap, green spider webs, somber ice deities. This is one of many so-called control points where suspicious bulbs can be monitored easily. In less than a fortnight, a gong sounds along the ice and stone corridors of the Phoebus headquarters, and faces swivel over briefly from their meters. Not too many gongs around here. Gongs are special. Byron has passed 1,000. Procedure now is standard. The Committee on Incandescent Anomalies sends a hitman to Berlin. But here, something odd happens. Yes, damned odd. The plan is to smash up Byron and send him back right there in the shop to Cullet and Batch, salvage the tungsten, of course, and let him be reincarnated in the glassblower's next project, a balloon setting out on a journey from the top of a white skyscraper. This wouldn't be too bad a deal for Byron. He knows as well as Phoebus does how many hours he has on him. Here in the shop, he's watched enough glass being melted back into the structureless pool from which all glass forms spring and respring, and wouldn't mind going through it himself. But he is trapped on the karmic wheel. The glowing orange batch is a taunt, a cruelty. There's no escape for Byron. He's doomed to an infinite regress of sockets and bulb snatchers. In zips young Hansel Geschwindig, a Weimar street urchin, twirls Byron out of the ceiling into a careful pocket, and geschwindig, out the door again. Darkness invades the dreams of the glassblower. Of all the unpleasantries, his dreams grab in out of the night air, and extinguished light is the worst. Light in his dreams was always hope, the basic mortal hope. As the contacts break helically away, hope turns to darkness, and the glassblower wakes sharply tonight, crying, "Who? Who?" Phoebus isn't exactly thrown into a frenzy. It's happened before. There is still a procedure to follow. It means more overtime for some employees, so there's that vague, full-boweled pleasure at the windfall, equally vague excitement at the break in routine. You want high emotion. Forget Phoebus. Their stone-faced search parties move out into the streets. They know more or less where in the city to look. They are assuming that no one among their consumers knows of Byron's immortality. So the data for non-immortal bulb snatchings ought to apply also to Byron. And the data happen to hump up in poor sections, Jewish sections, drug, homosexual, prostitute, and magic sections of the capital. Here are the most logical bulb snatchers in terms of what the crime is. Look at all the propaganda. It's a moral crime. Phoebus discovered, one of the great undiscovered discoveries of our time, that consumers need to feel a sense of sin. That guilt in proper invisible hands is a most powerful weapon. Lyle Bland and his psychologists had figures, expert testimony and money, money in the Puritan sense, an outward and visible okay on their intentions, enough to tip the discovery of guilt at the cusp between scientific theory and fact. Growth rates in later years were to bear Bland out. Actually, what bore Bland out was an honorary pallbearer sextet of all the senior members of Salutieri, Poor, Nash, De Brutus, and Short, plus Lyle Jr., who was sneezing. Buddy, at the last minute, decided to go see Dracula. He was better off. Of all the legacies Bland left around, the bulb-snatching heresy was perhaps his grandest. It doesn't just mean that somebody isn't buying a bulb. It also means that same somebody is not putting any power in that sun.